Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today something maybe a little bit unusual because, well, let me give you a little background. I went to college in the late 1960s and 1970s, and recently I had a class reunion. Got together with some of the folks that I spent time with in college, and I came across an old buddy who is an attorney, and he's going to shed some light on an issue that relates to the supplements that you take. So without further ado, here's John Jacobson, a guy that I used to share an apartment with on the Upper West Side during my college sojourn at Columbia College, who's now a successful attorney. He is a partner in a law firm called Wilson Sonsini, Goodrich & Rosati. It's hard to pronounce these law firm names. His specialty is in antitrust law. Now, what does that have to possibly do with the vitamins you take? Well, recently, there was a big case and attracted a lot of news about price fixing in the realm of vitamins. And to shed some light on that story, well, we got someone who was intimately involved in that case because it became a big case. John Jacobson was a principal in that. He was lead attorney in a case which argued this precise issue, the issue of price fixing among vitamin manufacturers. So, John, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. It's fun to interview an old college buddy.
And it's a great pleasure to be here, Ron. Let me start with a little history and background.
Sure.
In the mid to late 1990s, there was a massive price-fixing conspiracy uncovered involving a U.S. company, Arthur Daniels Midland, otherwise known as ADM. And they were fixing the prices with their European and Japanese colleagues of lysine, as well as some other products. And as a result of that investigation, which ultimately resulted in criminal convictions of a number of folks for price fixing, it's actually been the subject of a movie starring Matt Damon called The Informant, which I would commend to your readers. But as a result of that investigation, the Department of Justice learned that a European company by the name of Rhône Poulenc was also engaged in price fixing of other products. And lo and behold, you go into 1999, and one of the largest, probably the largest price fixing cartel in the history of our planet was uncovered. It was, the ringleader was a French company by the name of Roche. The participants included Rhône Poulenc and a German company by the name of BASF. Mm-hmm. And, there were a number of Japanese companies that were convicted of price fixing, as well.
Can you help us out with the implications of price fixing for the vitamin consumers? So what these companies were doing were they were getting together in smoke-filled rooms, or maybe these days not smoke-filled rooms, sitting together or coordinating how high they would set the prices for raw materials for some vitamins. I think Roche makes, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, vitamin E. Is that possible?
The principal vitamins that were the subject of that particular conspiracy, there was a little bit of vitamin E, but it was principally vitamin C, mm-hmm, vitamin A, vitamin D, and various of the B complex mm-hmm vitamins.
Okay.
And the prices for those products were raised significantly, and the production of those products was decrease, which tends to increase the price as well.
That's kind of like the OPEC of vitamin manufacturers. They kind of agreed to limit the supply intentionally to drive the prices up.
Yes, very much so. The difference is that OPEC has about 35 to 40% of the world market for petroleum, and these vitamin producers controlled over 65% of the market, so setting the market price was easier for them. And they also punished companies that would not join the conspiracy. Mm. So if there were smaller companies, one of the things they did was engage in what's called predatory pricing. Hmm. They would go after the companies with extremely low prices to either drive them out of business or more probably to get them to go along with the prices that were being charged, which is, you know, one of the traditional antitrust vices going back to the days of Standard Oil. But it was practiced with a vengeance in the vitamin case in the late 90s and early 2000s. Hmm. So as a result of this, there were fines exceeding from the U.S. Department of Justice over $1 billion and treble damage actions that resulted in also over $1 billion of recovery.
And the theory now, behind this, John, is to protect consumers from these the ravages of these anti-competitive practices. And of that $1 billion, does any of that money get plowed back into the pockets of consumers, or is just a fine to punish these companies and to disincentivize them to do this kind of stuff?
So the U.S. laws make it easier for so-called direct purchasers to recover. So the largest recovery was actually by the Coca-Cola company, which purchases a ton of these vitamins for, you know, use in its soft drinks, and PepsiCo and companies like Kraft and
like vitamin water, you know, and Gatorade. Yes. And things are, we're right, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yes. So the consumers can also sue, but it's difficult for them to recover, and the amount of the recovery tends to be trivial.
Right.
Most of the money goes
a buck and a quarter.
Money goes to the lawyers,
right?
Which, you know, is a feature of the system that a lot of people, including myself, dislike. But that is the system we have.
It is
now
what it is.
Overlaying this history, and I'll get to China in a minute because China is actually quite different. But overlaying this history is the fact that up until the 80s and 90s, price fixing was not seriously condemned in the rest of the world. It's been clearly illegal in the United States and some other countries since the 1890s. But in Europe, one of the earliest cases I worked on was price fixing of ocean shipping, you know, the fees charged to companies to put their containers on a ship, mm-hmm. and send them across the ocean. And a lot of the companies involved were Europeans, and the Europeans, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Australia, all passed statutes that made it a crime to produce documents to investigators or plaintiffs in the United States litigation because they were so opposed to this.
So this is part of their culture, part of their business culture was to do that, and it's thought to be an acceptable behavior until recently, I guess.
And that culture is what permeated companies like Rome, BASF, and that is, you know, the what made it to the people involved socially acceptable to engage in this conduct. But one of the things that occurred during the course of the 1980s, as everyone will recall, the Soviet Union economy collapsed, and people around the world began to realize that a market economy with strong competition laws produce better results for producers, for consumers, and for society as a whole. So over the course of the 80s and 90s, virtually all of Europe and beginning in the rest of the world, Asia was later to come along, began to impose penalties for price fixing. Now, in most countries, it's still a civil offense. It's a criminal offense in the United Kingdom. It's a criminal offense in the United States. But even in Europe today, with the great level of antitrust enforcement they have, it's punishable only by a fine to mm-hmm. the company, and individuals don't go to jail.
No perp walks.
In the United States, people go to jail, and people outside the United States who fix the price of products that are sold into the United States go to jail as well. And one of the things that the Department of Justice has been very aggressive on over the last 20 years is putting foreign citizens in jail for price fixing of goods that have been shipped into the United States.
Hmm.
So the vitamin conspiracy was massive one, resulted in tons of fines, lots of jail time. But it also caused some of the marginal producers of vitamin C to go out of business. And it caused the focus on vitamin C of some of the larger producers like Rhone Palanque, and like Roche, to decline. And China picked up on that. China at this point is moving very slowly from a communist economy into a hybrid economy that is, you know, governed by a communist government, but is a market-based economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese began to produce significant amounts of vitamin C. And over time, through the course of the 90s and into the 2000s, China began to dominate the sales of vitamin C. Now, the price of vitamin C tends to, in world markets, tends to fluctuate dramatically, and the Chinese government did not want those wild fluctuations to cause the vitamin C producers in China to undergo serious losses or to go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So China had a regulatory system in which the producers of vitamin C were told by the Chinese government, basically, please agree on the prices that you'll charge so that, you know, companies will stay in business and you'll all make money. Now that
so it's not quite price fixing. It's sort of in the interest of the economic interest of China, the way they regulate industry and sort of set the markers for the various commodities that they ship all over the world.
Yes, but it's very much price fixing. It's
okay.
Just price fixing that is commandeered by the Chinese government.
Right.
So as China moves more into a market economy and less into a regulated economy, the price of vitamin C is still going up, and class action lawyers in the United States get wind of the pricing activity and interview some people and find out that price fixing is going on in China. And they file a massive series of class actions against all of the Chinese vitamin producers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a defense under U.S. law that if a sovereign, and China obviously as a country is a sovereign, tells you to engage in the conduct, that U.S. law cannot prohibit conduct that mm-hmm. Your king, if you will, tells you have to engage in. So
mm-hmm.
that's a complete defense. So the Chinese companies all sought to have the price-fixing case, which was brought in Brooklyn, dismissed on the basis of the doctrine of sovereign compulsion, which, again, is a complete defense. In the alternative, they argued that international comity, the respect for determinations of other nations, should also bar the suit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for the first time ever in the U.S. judicial system, the Chinese government came in to court in Brooklyn and said, yes, in fact, we told these companies to do what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was argued before the court in Brooklyn. And fundamentally, the judge said, well, that's very nice for you to say that, but I don't believe you. And because the prices charged were not specifically the prices that you ordered them to charge, we're going to allow the case to go to a jury. So all of the companies settled except our clients, which went to trial. Another firm handled the trial. We were only brought in for the appeal. Mm-hmm. And they were found guilty, and ultimately a judgment was entered against them of $150-some-odd million, which
okay. That's not small change.
Is not chump change. So we then took the case to the Court of Appeals, and the notable event, the decision came out September 20th, the court said, well, this case really should have been dismissed, because if the Chinese government comes in and says, I told you to do this, it's not open to a U.S. court to basically thumb their nose at a government of a foreign country, and that this determination by China should have been respected and the case should not have been allowed.
So you through your intercession and through the legal team that you led, you, in a sense, got this company off the hook for a $150 million fine, correct?
Yes, that will go high on my resume. In actuality, it was going to be very difficult for the plaintiffs to collect the money, because the companies are Chinese, all of their assets are in China, and China wasn't really going to allow them to enforce the judgment. Mm-hmm. So there could have been another international crisis had, you know, a judgment enforcement efforts gone into effect. In fact, there were proceedings in the United States in an effort to collect the judgment, but nothing happened. One of the features of the case is that, in addition to going into court and making the pronouncements that the conduct had been compelled, the Chinese government also sent a formal statement. It's called a diplomatic note to the United States State Department saying, basically, you know, what's up with this?
Yeah.
Please stop it.
It's a State Department matter. It's on the one hand, they try to pursue it through legal action, but actually maybe this is a State Department matter that through some State Department efforts they can negotiate, you know, a better scenario for American consumers.
And that's exactly right. And the upshot of this is that the intergovernmental relations aspect of this prevailed over the sort of myopic focus on whether price fixing should happen or not. Mm-hmm. If the government tells you to fix prices, it's hard to say, well,
yep,
thank you very much, but no.
Yep.
And that was really the issue in the case. So yesterday the plaintiffs filed what's called a petition for rehearing en banc, which is a request for the full court. This is the U.S. Court of Appeals that sits in New York. It's called the Second Circuit. And they've asked, we had a panel of three judges. The full court is about 11 judges, and they've asked for the full court to hear the case. That's unlikely to happen. The Second Circuit grants those hearings only once every couple of years. But the plaintiffs are clearly going to ask the Supreme Court to take the case. And although we think they shouldn't, I can't say there's a zero possibility that this would wind up in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wow, of interest. So we'll follow that up. What's the ultimate take-home message for American consumers? Are they paying exorbitant prices because of these national policies that, in effect, are tantamount to price fixing? Is gouging going on, or is this just a feature of the marketplace?
Well, they're certainly paying prices that are higher than those than they would have paid had the Chinese government not done this. But there's a careful balance to be set between the social losses of companies going out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same in China as it is in the U.S., and that needs to be balanced against mm-hmm. you know, the interest in maintaining competitive prices. And China made a decision, you know, right or wrong, they made the decision that consumer prices could suffer a little bit to make sure that, you know, their business base continued to be.
I don't know that you can speak to the issue of quality control, because a lot of people are suspicious of Chinese goods. They're, you know, they're often they're a lot cheaper, but, you know, in some ways the you know, the governmental controls, the Chinese version of the FDA, less stringent about quality control. Is that is that an issue that was broached in this case at all?
Not in this case, and you can argue that in other contexts. But, you know, China is producing a lot of the components for our electronics,
yep.
and they're quite high quality. You know, yep. iPhones are fundamentally made in China. There was no suggestion that part of the agreement was to reduce the quality control mm-hmm. over vitamin C.
Okay.
And it is, you know, it is a chemical like ascorbic acid.
Yeah, and so it can be easily characterized. It's sort of, you know, it's hard to make counterfeit vitamin C if there's any kind of
right.
quality control or vetting or sampling of the ingredients.
Good. So, so anyway, that's the story. It's not quite over, but it's in terms of antitrust law, it's one of the more important decisions that we've seen in a couple of years in this area. And in terms of international relations, it's probably the single most important court decision we've seen in the last 10 years.
Well, congratulations to you to being involved in such an important case.
It was a total lark. It was a lot of fun, and I just hope we can hold on to the win through the rest of the proceedings.
Indeed. And so to think that about 45 years ago, I sat in a room adjacent to yours, and I may, you know, go in there to, you know, borrow something, and you'd be sitting there with, you know, with your nose in a law book. And this was your first-year law student. I know how you sweated over those law books. First year was murder. And to think that 45 years hence, that this would culminate in such an illustrious career. It's really quite remarkable what's happened over the span of time. So it was great getting back together with you, and I thank you for sharing your deep insights into this situation for our listeners. It's a confusing situation when you read about it, but you presented it in a very, very cogent way.
Thanks, Ron. Always good to talk to you, and happy to talk to your listeners.
Thanks so much, John. John Jacobson, who is an attorney involved in a big law case recently about the cartelization of vitamin C. He's a partner at Wilson Sonsini, Goodrich & Rosati. And if you've got something that involves antitrust litigation, he's the go-to guy. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Ron. All
Take
right,
care.
Bye-bye.